The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
And eligible families will receive a monthly payment of up to $300 per month for each child under the age of six, and up to $250 per month for each child age six until the year they turn over age six, sorry, till the year they turn 18.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was, of course, the White House Press Secretary, Jen Psaki. She said that it was related to new monthly payments for parents, which are going to be issued. You might be excited about it. I thought we'd take a look at these monthly payments that you're going to be getting, how much you're going to get, when will it end, and why we're doing it. ABC 11 will fill you in. Listen to this.
For families facing obstacles in affording child care, help may be on the way. The Treasury Department announcing today that the first monthly payment of the expanded child tax credit from the American Rescue Plan will be made on July 15th, impacting nearly 39 million households. Eligible families will receive up to $300 per month for each child under the age of 6 and up to $250 a month for each child 6 to 17 years old. Income limits are based on filing status, phasing out at different levels. Those payments will be made through direct deposit, paper check, or debit cards.
All right, so there you have it. Starting July 15th, mark your calendars. All right, parents, if you have children under the age of 18, you're going to start seeing payments from the federal government. Just show up in your bank account. This is a new program, and it started as a result of the American Rescue Plan that was passed back in February under the program, the child tax credit that people, you know, under a certain income level get when they file their taxes. They're going to have that credit paid out to them in advance. So just very simply, if you have a child under six, you're going to get an annual credit of about $3,600. What will you do with that extra $3,600, right? And if you have multiple kids under six, I remember one time my wife and I had five kids under six. That'd be a heck of a payout, wouldn't it? You're going to be getting $300 payments for each one of those children. For children between the ages of 6 and 18, $50 less. You're going to get about $250 per child. And the program is starting in the middle of the year, so parents are going to get the other half of the credit as a tax refund when they get their taxes next year. You know, so you're going to say, well, you know, you might, maybe you'll owe taxes. Maybe you won't. I don't know. But you can count on the other half of that at least coming your way. But the programming is starting on top of reports about the federal unemployment payments, you know, the extra $300 a week being paid out, causing a lot of people not to work for, not to look for work. So I don't know what the impact of this is going to be. I would think, gosh, I don't know. I know young parents, you know, an extra $300, extra $250 could go a long way to really help them with everything from diapers to clothes to whatever, right? But we've seen what happened when the government began giving a lot of money out. It incentivized people to say, stay home. You see, for sales, for work wanted, if you will, or applications for work all over the place. Businesses want you to come in. But nobody's working, right? Some governors have turned the spigot off on that, saying, look, we're going to pay that money out in a bonus after the person gets a job. That's not a bad idea, but it's only happening in a state-by-state basis. So there is a really big problem with millions of jobs, you know, millions of job openings being available, but nobody right now you know, applying for them. Employers are trying all kinds of things to attract workers, and they're not successful. You know, we've seen signing bonuses, right? We've seen all sorts of incentives to come in. They've raised even the minimum wage. There might be other reasons for this happening. One-fifth of parents, for instance, they say they can't get affordable child care. But a lot of experts are pointing at these extra unemployment payments as kind of being the main culprit of that. But bottom line here, and we're going to speak to Lee Edwards, who's a distinguished fellow in conservative thought at the Heritage Foundation. He's going to be joining me. Final thought here on this, and you're more than welcome to sound off too. Feel free to dial in. Let me know what you think. If you add these monthly tax credits on top of the extra unemployment benefits, this is just food for thought. Where's the incentive to work? You know, why not sit back? Let the government, you know, give you that unemployment, give them that bonus, give you this payout for having kids. Why not let the government fill your bank account automatically, huh? And is this a possible entryway into a form of universal basic income? Is it plowing the field, so to speak, making it fertile for that type of thought? And again, who doesn't like free money, right? Question is, where does it come from? You know, and ultimately, what happens when we run out of it? I'm joined today by, as I said, Lee Edwards. It's good to have him here with us. Also an adjunct professor of politics at the Catholic University of America and the chairman of the foundation that dedicated the Victims of Communism Memorial in Washington, D.C. in 2007. And it's wonderful to have you here with us today. Good afternoon, Doctor.
Thank you so much, Drew. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
This is talk about this subject.
You know, I want to be sensitive on it, too, because, you know, I understand. I had five children in like 6.5 years, and, you know, there was times it was really tough, and an extra couple hundred dollars here or there per kid would have made a huge difference in my life. I just worry about the apathy and the fact that some people won't go back to work. They'll look at this as an opportunity to take advantage of the government. It might even, as I said, open the doorway to the thought, you know, the acceptance of some universal care.
Well, I think you're right, Drew, and I think that you, in one sense, you can say this is something that certain people have been working towards for 100 years, since Woodrow Wilson and the progressives first beginning to talk about the role of government. And so the question which you're advancing here, it seems to me, is what does this do with regard to people's attitude about government? They're going to say, well, let's have more and more government, and we're not going to worry about paying for it because somebody else is going to be taxed, and I don't have to worry about even the fact that this is a free lunch. I welcome the free lunch. I welcome the free education. I welcome the free health care. All of this, I think it can be shown, is a part of what a plan, a century-long plan, which the progressives and the ultra-liberals have been working toward for 100 years, which is to have government as the cord, not just of last resort, but a first resort if there are problems. People have to understand there's going to be a cost to it. At one point, the bill is going to come due, and it may not come due to the people today, but it certainly will come due to people tomorrow and the next day after that.
Who was it? Margaret Thatcher that said, you know, socialism's great until you run out of other people's money. Is she the one who said
yes.
that?
Yes.
That's what I see here. I mean, this is great. Who, you know, there's a lot of people saying, oh, gosh, this is fantastic. Until we run out of other people's money. I mean, socialism, wherever it's been tried, has never worked. It has always failed. And I have grave concerns about what we're now seeing coming out of the Biden administration. And this is not partisan political talk. It's just, you know, trillions of dollars of debt is not a healthy thing for any country. And the Biden administration wants to continue to print and spend money. You know, the child tax credit payment, it just seems to be a situation of taking something people are going to get anyway and give it early. And, you know, will this be good? Let's take the other side of it. Maybe they're going to get it early and say, okay, we're going to pump it into the economy. Is it a good thing in some respects? Am I missing something here?
Well, I think that, you know, it's wonderful because, in a sense, for certain people at a certain level, as you're talking about, Drew, and that is, you know, if they're in need and they're worried about, you know, putting bread on the table, they're worried about getting their kids to be clothed properly and to get to school and to have an occasional movie they can go to and have some popcorn along with it and all the rest of it. But you always have to ask yourself, what is the ultimate cost of it? And what I worry about, and you just said it, and that is, you know, quoting Margaret Thatcher, you run out of other people's money. But what I'm concerned about, it seems to me, is we could run out of our money.
Right.
Not just the other people's money, but our money. And what happens then? What happens then is that people at all levels are going to be taxed to make up this difference and to pay for all of these bennies. And that's the situation in places like Sweden and Denmark, which are constantly thrown up to me as, you know, the wonderful socialist country. Well, A, they're not socialist. They have a free market which is responsible for their production, their transportation, energy, all the other things that they have. They have a free market economy. But to pay for their welfare system, they have an average of 55% tax
Wow.
on their income. 55%.
Wow.
And both there. So what do we are today? I mean, most people pay taxes of maybe half that, a third of that. Some people don't pay any tax, but everybody in Denmark pays something. Everybody. And that's the cost of the welfare state and of a so-called socialist country, which is not really a socialist country.
Well, my guest today is Professor Lee Edwards. If you want to join us, feel free to sound off, 888-914-9149. It's an open conversation here. You may agree, you may disagree. That's fine. Yeah, and I want to go back to the phones, but let me just ask you where it leads. Okay, because like I said, I know that the unemployment benefit, the tax credit for the child, that will certainly help a certain segment of the population. There's also others who I think take advantage of that. There's been talk that, you know, this is part of a much larger agenda, something that some of the liberals in government would really like to see, and that is a basic universal income at some point in time. And this is a good way at least to dip the toe in the water. Do you have any concern regarding that? And do you see this as a possible entryway into that philosophy and that approach?
Well, you know, that's even in some place like Sweden and Denmark, which are always thrown up, you know, with socialist countries, mm-hmm. which they're not, even they, though, do not have that kind of a guaranteed income. They depend upon the market to produce profit, to produce the income that they can then tax to pay for the welfare state. You know, it's an interesting balance which they've been able to achieve there. But let's keep in mind that Sweden is only 10 million, we're 330 million. And so it's going to be a heck of a lot more complicated than it is just to simply try to write out a check for people. But even, as I say, even Sweden doesn't try to do that. What is that going to do? Is that consistent with the American ideal of being able to, you know, achieve whatever goal you want if you work hard enough and long enough and if you have enough creativity and commitment and so forth? Is that in keeping with the American dream, with the American spirit, with the American ideal? And I think you can begin to say, wait a minute now, does that really do it? Isn't this, or is this part of what the socialists in this country, you can call them progressive, if you will, are saying, and that is to increase the size of government, to drive out the market, to limit the role of the individual, because they believe that a bureaucracy out in Washington, D.C. can make better decisions about how you and I and Catherine want to live and conduct our lives than we can.
Right. All right, let's move along. We'll take another call or two. Michael's listening in Kokana, Wisconsin. Michael, thanks for waiting. Good afternoon.
Yeah, thank you so much. I agree with most of what your guest is saying, almost 100%. But I was taken aback a little bit by your statement, Drew, and you said that what is the incentive for people to work? There are a lot of hardworking people out there that were really pushed aside by this pandemic. It's mostly people working in the service sector, hotels, restaurants, that type of person who were really, really put aside, who did have, just could not work. I was lucky to work through the pandemic. I'm working a professional position. I've actually worked harder and more hours during the pandemic, and the industry I'm in is actually being stressed by the pandemic. And so it's been good for me. When the times are down, my times are up. But please be careful when you say things like people. There are people that are going to gain the system, but there are a lot of people out there who are being hurt.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Michael, it's a good point. And I hope I clarified that a few moments ago when I made the case that I don't like to broad brush things, that there are certain segments of the population that certainly can be benefited from this. And you know, no doubt in my mind, I think of the dry cleaners. I think of the people in the travel agencies. I have a friend who's a travel agent. People in restaurants and service industries, they were hammered by this and they suffered. And this really helped them bridge the gap. So I think it really served a purpose. The extension of it, I question a little bit. I saw a news report the other day just to validate the other side of the equation. There was a motel owner, and he says, people are back. Now they're vaccinated. Now they're out. I says, I could rent so many more rooms in this hotel of mine, this motel. He says, but I don't have anyone who wants to come and work to clean the rooms to change the beds because they're making more at home than they are actually coming to work. So, look, it's not any single Okay. So like I said, I think there are people who always take advantage of opportunities when they can. I'm not saying everybody does that. And to your point, I think there's a lot of people who benefited from it. And I think that's a solid point. Professor, do you want to follow up on that at all?
I think I'd generally agree with what you're saying, Drew. But I would just say that hopefully what would happen is that, again, the market, which we still have, would work this out, that people would see that, well, I'm getting sick and tired of sitting around here on my duff. I want to get out and get back into working, because I think that people really sort of manifest what they're really all about and who they really are by working and not by staying home, watching TV, knocking back a six-pack or two. Right. And I think that there's enough of the American spirit left that most people would not become addicted, hopefully. Right. Would not become addicted to that payout from the federal government.
We're speaking with Professor Lee Edwards. We're taking a look at the Child Tax Credit Advance Payment. We're taking a look at universal income. There are certain people that are still not going back to work. So maybe we should distinguish, pandemic at its zenith versus where we are right now. There's also this proposal coming forth. In fact, as of July 15th, if you have a child under six, you'll automatically get $3,600, $300 a month payment for you, and the rest has a tax refund. If you have a child that is 6 to 18 years of age, it'll be $250. So if you've got a big family, I've got some friends that have 7 and 8 kids, it could be a big payout for them. So, but we'll see. And it blesses a lot of families, it helps a lot of families, but there is some concern where this might lead. You might remember the Democratic candidates when they were during the last election debating. I remember them on the stage. They were all talking about how to make health care free, higher education free, the forgiveness of student loan debts. And believe me, these are all problems. I've got kids that carry student loan debts. I understand. My heart goes out to anyone who has that. And then you'll hear people come in and say, well, what about the Nordic countries? Look at what they've done. And then you have certain senators and certain people in the country who floated universal basic income for states. So we are in a strange new time, and this concept is being floated. I thought it'd be great just to talk about it with you today to better understand it and see what the implications of it are. And I've invited to the conversation today Professor Lee Edwards, and I was telling him during the break how much I enjoy his rationality and his calm demeanor. I do. It's good to talk with you, Professor.
Thank you, Drew, so much for having me back.
So where, before we go to the phones, where does this go? I'm just curious as to how you see things evolving. We have a different administration today. That could change in a couple of years. But how do you see things unfolding?
Well, I'm concerned, Drew, because if we continue to have a constant increase of government, and if we continue to have things like the individual out there trying to be a little bit different, if he is not going to be allowed to be that, then I'm concerned. Is this administration, and I think trying to do the right thing, trying to help people who are in need at a time of crisis, we all have to agree and understand about that. Yeah. And that's one thing. But are we leading to a situation where people are going to automatically always expect the government to help it? Yeah. And what does that do to the American way, which has been built on much more rugged individualism than that kind of constant government help and government subsidization? So I just think we have to be very, very careful about that. Is this going to be something that becomes permanent in our lives?
Yeah, that's such,
and who's going to pay
point.
For it?
That's such a great point. Two great important questions. Adriana is listening in Los Angeles. Adriana, welcome. You're on the air with Professor Lee Edwards.
Thank you, Drew and Professor. I was just going to comment that I've seen both sides of people not wanting to work in really good jobs because they were making more on unemployment. And I've seen the people that are still waiting for unemployment to either approve or deny their claim. So my thought was, why not invest that money that they want to give out monthly starting July 15th for the children, the payments, to invest that in the economy, help the small businesses, especially the ones that had to close, And that way you help the people get, everybody gets back on their feet that way. Because, I mean, I know people are struggling, but you don't want to depend on that. And I would much rather see that money go towards opening up all the small businesses that will then employ people long term.
Well, I think that's a wonderful point. And as a matter of fact, a part of this, particular programs which the Biden administration are putting forward are intended to be loans to small businesses. I know some friends of mine who have been receiving some of those, and that has resulted in their being able to hire some people and to even talk about maybe expanding their business. And you know, these are mom-and-pop operations, not GM and GE kind of a thing. So, yes, that's something which is part of what's going on right now. And after all, small business produces more than 50% of the jobs in this country. So they're a vital part of our economy and need to be helped so they're not hurt by this kind of a crisis that we've been trying to come out of.
Yeah, well said. Susie in St. Charles, Illinois. Good afternoon. You're on the air with Professor Edwards.
Hi, Drew. Hi, Professor. I just want some clarification. All families are going to get this money, or like our daughter and her husband work full-time. They make good money. Yeah. They have two little kids. Are they going to get that money?
Yeah, my understanding is it goes out to everyone. It goes out. And Professor, maybe you can clarify the point if you're aware of that. My understanding is if you have a child that's, you know, under a certain age, you get that payout. Are you familiar? Is there any income cap on that?
I'm not familiar with the particulars of that, so I just can't speak to it. But that's a vital question.
And, you know, on second thought, I do. I think there is an income cap. They can't just give that money out. There is an income cap. I don't know what that number is. And maybe if Patrick's on my board or one of my call screens, maybe you can look that up. See what the income cap is. So I'll share that when we come back. That's a great point, Susie. Thank you. But I don't think you have to be on unemployment or anything else. I just think that if you make under X amount of dollars, my understanding is that you'll get that $300 a month for any child under 6, and any child between 6 and 18, $250 a month. We'll get that for you momentarily, so hopefully we'll dig that number up.
I think you're right.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an income cap. I'm absolutely positive of it, in fact. Let me go to who's next while we wait for that info. Is it Abby listening in Flagstaff, Arizona? Hi, Abby. Good afternoon.
Hi. So there is a cap. It's $150,000 for a married couple.
Perfect.
$150,000.
Thank you for that.
So that's kind of my question. My husband makes very good money, and I stay at home with 5 children. We don't really need the stimulus. He's always been employed. Our kids go to Catholic school. We also don't need this child care tax, whatever it is. What do we do with that money that automatically gets deposited, whether we want it or not?
All right, what a great question. So are you asking, can you turn it back and say no? I would donate it to a very worthy cause. I would too.
That's exactly. To your favorite Catholic charity, or maybe even if you can find a good Protestant one as well.
Yeah, amen to that. So yeah, I don't know if you can return it, Abby. I mean, maybe you can reject it. I don't know how that process goes. Seems like it might be a lot of work. Relevant Radio is a great nonprofit for you, but there's a lot of good, you know, people who might need help with their education. Or I mean, there's lots of causes, pro-life groups. I would use it in a positive way.
For sure. When we donate to the Sisters of Life, they're our favorite ladies, so
there
maybe that's the route we'll go.
That sounds great. You can always increase your donation. Sounds good. Thank you. It's a great question. Thanks for bringing clarity to that. Again, the income levels, as she pointed out, is $150,000 for married couples for that. And Jake is confirming that for me right now, too. So that's great. That's a good question. I love her heart. Hey, we don't need it. What should we do with it? You know, can we not take it? Well, I would use it for a cause that advances the common good somehow. I think that's a great thing. Professor, thank you for your time. Always enjoy connecting with you. If people want to follow you, read your work, what's the best way to do that?
Heritage.org.
All right, great institution. Thank you, Professor. We'll talk again soon, I hope, okay?
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, Visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
It really grieves me that this question needs to be asked. It's understandable that it's being asked, but it should be known by everyone that Catholics don't support anything that advocates for an injustice or deprivation of the basic human right, such as the right to life.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, it's great to be with you today. Did you hear about what Nancy Pelosi had to say regarding the Eucharist? And again, like I don't want to throw stones at people. You know that. But I do want to be very clear on what the church teaches. And I do think we have an obligation to speak the truth and to speak it with love. And I think, as you believe, you know, as I believe, that the Eucharist is the source and summit of our faith. You know, last week there was more controversy over the question of pro-abortion politicians and communions. I touched on it briefly. I haven't dwelt on it in great detail, but it came in the context of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying that she basically agrees with a letter that the Cardinal Luis Ladaria, who heads up the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, sent to Archbishop Jose Gomez, the president here in our country, the United States Catholic Bishops, USCCB, and basically outlined principles for the bishops to look at this question as a whole. And Cardinal Ladaria, he wrote the letter at the request of two cardinals, really, Cardinal Blaise Supich of Chicago and Joseph Tobin of Newark, who wanted his intervention because, you know, the bishops have been discussing this issue a lot lately. And look, Joe Biden's making it hard for him. The White House press secretary, or press spokeswoman, I should say, Jen Psaki, says that Biden wants to codify Roe. He wants to, the administration's going to go ahead and do that. So, you know, this is turning up the water, I think, for our nation's bishops. And the bishops are also going to be talking about this in their June meeting, and we'll see what happens there. But you know, in a few moments, Archbishop Cordiglione is going to be joining me. He is Nancy Pelosi's bishop, too, and I'd love to get his take. But listen to the bold stance that Archbishop Olmsted of Phoenix took when he was asked about pro-abortion politicians receiving the communion. This was on Pro-Life Weekly not too long ago.
Well, I think we need to speak up, especially about the Eucharist, about being such a great gift from God, and that we have to have a deep, deep reverence in our own hearts for Christ. And if we have any sense that there's actions that are going on that are directly contrary to an appreciation of the Eucharist, that we need to speak up about that. It's the great treasure that we have a church. So we need to be defending that. And then we need to do all we can to help those who may be engaged in that activity to understand why it's wrong and why it's not good for their own souls either. I think that I have a duty. I think we bishops have a duty to speak as pastors. We're not politicians, we're pastors. And that means the care of souls is our first concern, both the good of souls and then anything that could be a scandal to them or could mislead them about what's true and good and beautiful.
That was, again, the great Archbishop, or Bishop, I should say, Olmsted. And again, I ask you to pray for all of our bishops. They're in a very difficult position. Archbishop Olmsted, very clear, very charitable, very kind. Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione was on the show, I think it was about 2 weeks ago. He came out with a letter that he published for his archdiocese. It was clear. It was bold. It was charitable and loving. Nancy Pelosi, as I was saying, is a member of his diocese, and the letter that he published states that no politician who supports abortion should receive communion until they repent of their position. That's just church teaching, right? That's nothing new. It's not to me, it's not controversial. So he is out with a response to Speaker Pelosi, saying that she basically agrees with, you know, Cardinal Ladaria's letter. And the Archbishop's response? Good, he says, because I do too. So that means we have a common place from where we can start talking. I love it. I love that. The great Archbishop is with us today. Your Excellency, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hey, thank you so much. Can you sum up for those who are maybe not up to speed on the issue what Cardinal Ladaria said in his letter that Speaker Pelosi was so willing to agree to.
Yes, he first spoke about, as bishops are discerning the situation of Catholics prominent in political life who espouse evils such as abortion, to follow the principles that were laid out in the letter of the then Cardinal Ratzinger back in 2004, a private letter to the U.S. bishops, which spoke about having to engage the politician in conversation. First of all, he said that to promote abortion and euthanasia is a formal cooperation in a grave sin.
Yeah.
So this is a very serious matter for, I would say, any Catholic who does that, all the more so any Catholic in public life. And that to have, in the best situation, the bishop have a conversation and try to help them understand the evil that they're helping to perpetrate and move them to a change of heart. And if after many attempts that proves fruitless, then the bishop is to declare that the person not be admitted to communion. He also spoke about the need for the bishops to dialogue among themselves before deciding a national policy, and so that the bishop's authority in his own diocese is recognized and is respected, and in order to preserve unity. So I would point out that what we're deliberating on in the USCCB is not a national policy, but rather a document that would reinforce and clarify the teaching of the church and the bishop's authority and responsibility in this matter.
So really, there won't be one blanket policy that applies across, you know, the country. Will it be left up to individual bishops then to speak to these wayward politicians? Joe Biden had announced, or his press spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, indicated that the administration plans on codifying Roe v. Wade. You know, we have Nancy Pelosi. There are a number of other people as well. Will it be up to the individual bishop? And I'm assuming most bishops do that. I would think if I was a bishop of a diocese, I had somebody, let's say President Biden or someone else in, you know, is one of my flock in love and charity, I would speak to them. Is that being done now? And how will this document, you know, make a difference? Will it empower the bishops more? I mean, or make clear the teaching to those who are wayward? Maybe put that into context or clarity for me, if you could.
These conversations do happen. Many bishops have had these conversations. I think this document, my hope is that it would give support to a bishop who is engaging in this and might have to make that very unpleasant decision, that because the point of this letter, again, is reinforcing church teaching and the bishop's responsibility and authority in his diocese, so it would be a support for him. There are some differences of opinion among, hopefully there's no differences of opinion about the church teaching, and that people formerly cooperating in grave evil should not present themselves for communion. There are differences of opinion about if and when to apply that discipline. And a bishop in his own particular situation, given the individual, given the situation in his own diocese, there's a whole number of factors he has to weigh in making that decision. So I would hope this document would give support and clearer perception of legitimacy of a bishop who does make such a decision.
Right. Now, I know you cited then Cardinal Ratzinger's letter from 2002 that confirmed that consistently advocating for abortion and euthanasia, it's not just abortion, that constitutes formal cooperation in grave sin, which you referenced a little bit earlier. What will that mean for those who are engaging or who are doing that? Does it lead to, gosh, I don't want to say excommunication. Is there, where does it lead to? What happens?
What I think we need to do is raise the profile of the evil that abortion is.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've become so inured to it. It's such a part of our daily life. It's so imbued in the culture. And the evil is so horrendous, we don't look at it. And the other side has all of these reflection techniques with the language game. They call it a woman's choice, but they don't talk about what the choice involves, right? And they talk about reproductive health. So that's why I started out with just exposing the bare face of the evil. We're talking, in the last 50 years in the United States alone, 66 million babies murdered in their mother's wombs.
Wow.
Just to comprehend the magnitude of that evil. 66 million babies. murdered in their mother's wombs. And then there are all the many more millions of lives affected by that. Women who are grieving their abortion and not able to speak about it. They're shut down if they are utter word about it. So we need to be truly pro-life in the sense of we're anti-abortion and we're pro-life, helping these women to heal. We're the only ones who offer those resources. Off-world pro-life and crisis pregnancy clinics that give women real choice, happy choices. So what I think we need to do is help people look at the brutal reality and evil of abortion straight in the face so we can begin to move people to a change of heart.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. The other thing is just from a spiritual perspective, Your Excellency, too, I know we can talk about type of legislation that's going on or policies that'll be enacted coming out of the USCCB. But I mean, we really, I think, this is a spiritual thing. It's a demonic thing at the very core of it. I think there needs to be greater prayer and fasting on the part of the laity. Is there anything planned in the future to call people to really recognize the fact that at the heart of this is a very dark evil, that this is a spiritual thing? And yeah, I mean, political action is important. Education is important. Activism is important. All these things are important. But it is the prayer and fasting that animates things. It's the prayer and fasting that will ultimately, I think, help to accelerate and bring about this change.
Yes, we definitely need that. To be honest, I've been rather disappointed at how ineffective that's been. We had about 10 years ago, we had a USCCB initiated a call to prayer and fasting for life, liberty, and religious liberty and marriage. But the resource was on the website, but it did not get a lot of publicity, and I think very few Catholics even knew about it. When I consecrated our archdiocese to the Immaculate Heart of Mary a little over 3 years ago now, about 3.5 years ago, I keep reminding people to live the consecration of praying the rosary daily, an hour of adoration a week, and fasting on Friday. That it's something we need to keep repeating over and over to get the message out. Absolutely, this is a spiritual battle. Absolutely, this is demonic. This is demonic, killing the babies. So we need to be engaged on that spiritual level, but it's something that we need to just push out there and repeat over and over so people begin to hear about the need for prayer and fasting on this.
Yeah. Well, what do you expect to come out of the USCCB's discussion on this issue? I mean, it's really not a fair question, but if you want to take a swing at it, what do you think will manifest?
Well, I don't want to make any predictions, but I would say I'm sensing an increasing concern and urgency among the bishops about saying something very clear and strong, because there is a lot of scandal in the technical sense. Catholics prominent in public life are misleading Catholics and non-Catholics, thinking that it's somehow it's acceptable to believe that it's okay to kill babies in the womb. I had one of my interviews with a secular media station. The interviewer was friendly, so he wasn't like trying to put me on the spot or anything, but sincerely asked, is it possible for a Catholic to be pro-abortion? And so the very fact that question can sincerely be asked shows that there is scandal here because people are confused. Catholics cannot condone killing innocent human lives. So I think there's a sense of the urgency, a growing sense of urgency among the bishops to do something very strong and definitive about this.
So on that point, Your Excellency, and I don't mean any disrespect, but I mean, what about Nancy Pelosi, who professes to be a Catholic, or Joe Biden, who says he's a Catholic and carries his rosary beads? And I pray for our country every day, and especially for these leaders, because I pray the seeds of those the Catholic faith will really blossom in them. How does such intelligent people not recognize that this is an intrinsic evil, and how can they in any way champion and advance this? And we know what's happened with the Mexico City policy and all the other policies that are taking place. So, I mean, if you could address it, I'm assuming you've spoken to Nancy Pelosi. I know you must have. You're a good shepherd. I mean, how do we get our heads around this very public disconnect that these people seem to have? I don't know how they justify or rationalize their position.
I don't either. It's always perplexed me. It's always perplexed me. I just don't know. I don't know. I don't know how someone with an education in medicine, a physician, could perform an abortion. And the physician, more than anyone else, knows what it involves. I just don't know. So I would ask your listeners to please pray for me. I have had some conversations, and I'm continuing that process. I'm not at the end of that road yet.
Right.
So please pray for me. Please pray for our Catholics in public life, that they will consistently advocate for life, dignity of human life in every stage and in every condition.
Well, I promise you my prayers, and I know that those who are listening will be praying for you, for Nancy, for all those who hold public office, that very noble vocation. But Your Excellency, thank you for being vocal, for being, you know, clear in your writing, for your leadership, and for your willingness to come on today. It's an honor to be in your diocese, and it's an honor to talk with you today.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me on the show and for all you do as well.
Thank you. That's His Excellency, Archbishop Cordy de Leone. Please, as he asked, pray for him. Let's pray for Nancy Pelosi. I know Nancy and perhaps Joe Biden and these policies when it comes to life can really, you know, get your blood boiling. And it's so much easier to reciprocate with anger and hatred and all sorts of other emotions towards them. But it is love. It is prayer. It is fasting, as I say. And it's not trite. I don't mean that in a trite way. That really will affect change. And it really, their immortal souls are what hang in the balance right now. So let's pray for them, and let's do so in earnest.
This is the Drew Mariani Show, Relevant Radio.
Well, the discussion about pro-abortion politicians and communion is getting hot, and it's actually reaching a high level of attention in Rome. The U.S. is, as far as I can tell, the only place where this discussion is really happening. It's not happening in Europe. Abortion really isn't on the table in Africa. It's only starting to make headway in South America now. And those who push for it in Asia, they're not Catholic, of course. So the discussion can seem like an annoyance, I think, to some in Rome. Well, those crazy Americans, right? They're obsessed with these sexual issues. You know, it's a good discussion to have because, as you heard Archbishop Cordy de Leone say, 66 million children have lost their lives since Roe v. Wade. Since 1973, and politicians continue to push it, like our so-called Catholic president. Jen Psaki, if you're just joining me, the spokeswoman, said Joe Biden wants to put Roe v. Wade officially into the law of the land. And those politicians, personally, I think, need to be held accountable here on earth. And you know, there should be a warning to them of the accountability they're going to render when they stand before God and his throne. So I'll invite you to pray for them, as I've said. I'm joined right now by Father Robert Gall. He's an associate professor of ethics at the Pontifical University of the Holy Cross in Rome, and he's joining us there. Good evening, Father. Buonasera.
Thank you. Thank you, Drew. It's great to be on the show, and especially after those amazing words from Archbishop Cordy de Leone.
Yeah, isn't he bold and clear? I love it. I mean, he doesn't pull punches, and I'm proud he's one of our great shepherds. Father, do you remember that, you know, well, let me put it this way. Do people recognize that, you know, this is an issue not just of life and death here on earth, but, I mean, there's spiritual consequences for this. And as I was saying to Archbishop Cordy de Leone, I know you probably heard that. Yeah, how does a Catholic like Joe Biden or Nancy Pelosi, we can go through a litany of others, not just the two of them, but they're in the headlines today. How do they not understand the eternal ramifications of this? And how do they not, from a temporal perspective, understand this intrinsic evil causes the destruction of human life?
What I found really overwhelming from Archbishop Cordy de Leone wasn't so much his force and clarity, which I'm used to coming from him, but there was a moment when you asked him exactly that question, and he responded very mildly and pensively and very slowly when he asked for prayers. And specifically, you challenged him about his conversations with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, and that was his response, that pray for me. So I mean, this is ongoing, and as you've put it, it really is a kind of spiritual warfare. And I think that I would like to, in a sense, turn things upside down. I mean, we've been emphasizing abortion. Abortion is extremely important. It's a horrible evil, and it's not just in the United States. And yet U.S. politicians, including the president of the United States, is having a huge impact promoting abortion on the worldwide level. He recently removed the United States from this, what's called the Geneva Accord, that has to do with specifying at international levels before UN agencies that the right to health and to medical care, and therefore to reproductive health, does not include the right to abortion. This was a policy under Trump that he got the agreement of some 60 different nations in order to push for such an interpretation of UN rights speech in such a way that it would not include abortion, but this was just removed in Geneva by the US government. So this is a really big issue, abortion, and it's a horrible evil, and yet I think we might be missing the picture in this debate if we don't focus primarily on the Holy Eucharist and on the need really to deepen our faith in the Holy Eucharist and to help our brothers and sisters in the faith to realize that Jesus is truly present, really present. There was this, just 2 years ago, the Pew Research came out with a study of Catholics, and it was shocking that they found that 7 out of 10 Catholics don't believe in the real presence. Now, it'd be interesting to look at how that maps out in terms of those who go to church and those who don't go to church. So when we're speaking about this this policy of the church and this pastoral practice of admonishing those who are engaged in such heinous behavior like promoting abortion that they ought not to approach for Holy Communion, it's because of our love for Jesus in the Holy Eucharist.
Yeah, it's such an important point. You know, and there's a lot of Catholics who, you know, want to see, you know, Canon 915 employed. They want to see these politicians perhaps even excommunicated. But, you know, there's this debate, Father, over using the Eucharist as a political tool with the politicians. What would best be served? Do you sit down with Joe Biden or Nancy or whoever it may be and just try to educate them on the fact, hey, if you're a Catholic, then here's what we believe as Catholics regarding the true presence? I mean, how do we get that across them? Because you're right. Maybe a different perspective, a different tact in the approach to this discussion might be revelatory.
In fact, I think that's exactly what Cardinal Ladaria is asking for in his letter to Archbishop Jose Gomez, which is really a letter to the U.S. Bishops' Conference. So Cardinal Ladaria is the head of the Congregation for Doctrine of the Faith, you know, what used to be headed up by Cardinal Ratzinger before he became the Pope. And many people, the media has been interpreting, and certainly the media on the left is interpreting Ladaria's letter as being telling the U.S. bishops to hold their horses and not to come out with any document and really not to speak out on this issue. But that's not at all what he's saying. What he is doing in that letter is he is putting the primacy on the Holy Eucharist and on, I mean, people say dialogue, but it's really education, it's evangelization, and it's teaching, so that these bishops should be meeting with these politicians. It's not just an issue of politicians, it's also an issue of those who voted for these politicians in addition. And if they voted for them in some way thinking that they would be promoting these policies regarding abortion, for instance, that too is very serious. But of course, they've done so privately, because one votes in the booth and one's all alone, and there's secrecy with respect to one's ballot. But as you mentioned, Drew, and rightly, Canon 915, it has to do with a public scandal of someone who is obstinately persevering in manifest grave sin. And promoting this evil is certainly a manifest grave sin, about which, though, they may not be culpable. Right. Because we can't judge anyone's the intimacy of their conscience, and who knows what formation they've received in the past, who knows what understanding they have today of this reality. I mean, it's kind of shocking to say that, but and it's hard to fathom how someone could be so blind to this reality. And yet this is the reason why they need to be instructed, they need to be spoken with. And so one would certainly hope, and this is also what Cardinal Ladaria is saying, is that before telling them that they can't, but before refusing Holy Communion from them, like at the altar rail, they should not even approach until they have not only changed their position, but they should publicly rectify in order to heal the scandal that they've caused. Well, the polarization that's happening in politics is such that this is also being driven by social media, that we tend to relate more and more and have conversations more and more with people with whom we agree. Mm-hmm. And this can keep us from appreciating the other side, the other position, and make it hard for us to understand how someone could have an opinion that's different from ours. But, you know, among the bishops, they're at like priorities with respect to other political issues, which would cause them to lean in one direction or another. But just before concluding, I wanted to mention these words of St. Paul.
Whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord unworthily sins against the body and blood of the Lord. This is from First Letter to Corinthians.
Amen to that.
Here's another Relevant Radio miracle moment.
Drew, I've been praying at chaplet for, years. And it's only because of the chaplet that my cancer was removed successfully on March 4th.
Right.
And you are instrumental in that. And so are the people at Relevant Radio. But I've got kind of a pen pal up there in Green Bay. Her name is Suzanne. And she, on the day of my surgery, I'm going to cry. The day of my surgery, she prayed for me on the chaplet and at 7 o'clock with Father Rocky. And I don't know how to thank her. And you guys know, the thing is, the miracle wasn't the curing of the cancer. Was realizing how many people are involved in it, and how many people prayed for me.
Thank you, and it was my honor to pray for you.
How has Relevant Radio impacted your life? Make a tax-deductible donation now on the Relevant Radio website or app.
It's so very encouraging to hear from our listeners who benefit from our programming. I want to invite you to join the St. Joseph Recurring Gift Society. Your ongoing monthly gift is a gift that keeps on giving.
Learn more at relevantradio.com/Joseph.